So, welcome to this session on MOOCs. With respect to all this MOOC commotion that swirls around us these days, one hears detractors saying that the MOOC is a kind of traditional lecture course wolf in sheep's clothing, a retreat to the past, a retreat and not an advance. Others say it is the future of higher education entirely. Still others say it is not the MOOC so much, but what comes after the MOOC is what's important. So however that may be and however that might work itself out, we all know that a great deal of interest, time, energy, and resource is being expended on MOOCs right now. So we might ask, what's the return on this investment, on the investment that we're making in MOOCs right now? What can the early practitioners of the MOOC art tell us that might help us both understand the MOOC better, but also understand better how to conduct our traditional curricula on our campuses? So it's my pleasure to introduce two early practitioners of this art, and they're going to share with you their experience of working with Coursera and perhaps bringing some lessons learned back from the ranch. So it's Lynn O'Brien, who's Director of Academic Technology and Instructional Services at Duke University. Deirdre Woods is Interim Executive Director of the Opening Learning Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. Please begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for attending this session. Deirdre and I are going to take turns. We tried to combine our ideas rather than doing two separate presentations, so that means we'll be going back and forth a little bit today. And we'll talk about what experiences we have that are similar at our institutions and what kinds of things are different. So the first question that I hear frequently, and I suspect Deirdre does as well, when we talk either on campus or in other places is, why are your institutions doing this? Why experiment with MOOCs at all? So a couple of things that we felt both of our schools had in common are the things that you see on this slide. Universities have long had a commitment to sharing their knowledge with a broader society, and Duke in particular has had as one of its strategic objectives for at least the last 6 or 7 years, a very explicit objective to share our knowledge and service to society. But another major driver of the MOOC activity on our campuses is to spur teaching innovation, both in the online realm and also in the campus-based class area. You may have heard this week, I think it was just yesterday, that there was one MOOC class about teaching MOOCs that had some technology problems and organizational problems, and they've temporarily halted it. And I've heard a couple of people say, aha, see, I know, they don't work. And I would encourage us as educators and people who support educators to try to model the same thing that we say we want from our students, that is an open-minded consideration of lots of different things, a willingness to try new things, and a willingness to experiment. And when you experiment, that means sometimes things go wrong. And so that seems to me to be a natural part of the process. But we'll both be talking a little bit about some of the ways teaching on our campus is changing already as a result of our MOOC experimentation. We certainly hope to reach a global audience, and I think our early data from our classes so far shows that we have. And then thinking about the long-term business model is something that's still very much up in the air, but interesting to think about even now. So what are these innovative teaching practices that are being spurred by MOOC experimentation? I listed a couple of the ones that are happening at Duke right now. Some of these are not new. We had been experimenting with flipped classrooms and team-based learning for several years already, but the new foray into MOOCs seems to be accelerating that trend with more people suddenly saying, you know what, I do think I could do a lot more of the didactic work outside of class time and use my in-class time for other things. The flexible course length has been one of the most interesting things for me to see. When we began working with our instructors on MOOC courses, they said, as you can imagine, well, when does the course start? When does it end? How long do they have to be? And I said, they can be any length you want. They can start any time you want. They can end any time you want. And at first, that kind of took people back a little bit. But what has been interesting for me to observe is that our traditional semester length at Duke is 14 weeks. It's been that way for a long time. not a single one of our MOOC instructors decided to do a 14-week course. They immediately began saying things like, well, you know, I always thought my course would work better as 2 6-week courses because some people don't really need the first half and some people aren't up for the second half. Maybe I'll do it in that way. Or another person would say, you know, there's a logical ending to the course after 10 weeks, but I've just added some stuff onto it because it has to be 14 weeks. So that kind of a conversation, even about course length, has been very interesting. And we're actually beginning to have faculty discussions around whether we want to think about a different credit hour system for the way we do courses at Duke. So that's been one example. Modular and reusable content, as faculty have started talking about it, saying, you know what, the 3 weeks in the middle of your course would actually be really useful background information for my course. And now that we're not constrained by the way our courses are set up in the course handbook or the registrar system, we could make those sorts of changes. And students, we know, are already using the courses, not only from our own institutions, but from others, to sample things, to get their background ready before they take a credit-bearing course or for doing more advanced work. A couple of other things that are happening, at Duke at least, we've also decided to do a second experiment with another company called 2U, and that one is going to offer credit-based courses for our undergraduates online. That's something we haven't done before at Duke. We know that our students will be coming in to our classes having already taken either some of our courses or other people's courses, so that's going to have an impact on our curriculum. The open access has been a very interesting thing as well because we've had faculty who are starting to say, you mean I can't use my own articles that I published in my open MOOC class without permission from my publisher? So we've been trying to have conversations around open access scholarly publishing for years, but this has brought it to the fore. And the last item on here that I'll mention as a small thing that leads to some bigger discussions, the students and faculty both at Duke have been saying, you know what, those little 1 or 2 minute videos for the Coursera courses, those are really hard things to do because you have to say in a minute or two, what is my course about? What do you have to be able to do in the course? And why is it really interesting and fun? But I think it would be great to have that for every course. So some of our students have been saying, you know, why don't we have those sorts of promotional videos for every course so we could get a little sample of what people are doing? So those are just a few. Oops. Excuse me with this. Where is my mouse? I'm not sure why it's doing that. Ugh, there we go. We're back. All right. Next up, I think you're going to talk a little bit about some of these things.
Yes.
Can, right?
Yes. So good morning, everybody. The format's not exactly perfect. If you have questions, we'll have some time for questions and answers at the end. But if you have questions, raise your hand. I will repeat them because we're being streamed, and then we'll have a more formal Q&A at the end. And one of the other things I wanted to tell you is I really feel, Lynn and I were talking about this, I feel like we're living in the book, The Tipping Point. It's so extraordinarily interesting to be in this era, this time period of technology and education. I've been in this business for many, many years, and the level of conversation that on campuses and the excitement around MOOCs have been really fantastic. I also think, you know, we are very much at the infancy of this whole new era. And I think, you know, no matter what happens, I think for institutions such as the University of Pennsylvania and for Duke University, it is imperative for these institutions to be in the conversation, contributing to the dialogue, leading the conversation, as opposed to standing on the sidelines. So going a little bit further into knowledge creation and dissemination, which is clearly a mission of an institution like Penn and Duke. So some of the things we've thought about is looking at what we're calling high quality gateway courses. We have a calculus course, a microeconomics course, a finance course. Of course, we think these are extraordinary courses, and we're thinking about how we deliver them to a much broader audience, you know, to serve the public good and also to experiment with some different models of delivering gateway content. Another place that the MOOCs have really, we've seen a great impact is in, you know, the contribution to public debate about really important issues. So we had a healthcare policy at course we taught last summer with Dr. Zeke Emanuel, and it just so happened that the Supreme Court ruling on healthcare came down while he was talking about that, and he was able to Skype in to discuss this. At Duke, there's a genetics and evolution course that, you know, is a conversation about science and science teaching is going on in this country today, to have, you know, a world-class expert comment on that. We also taught a vaccines course at Penn, again, more for a public service cost about the history of vaccines, again, to enter the public policy debate about very important issues that are going on in society today. And then what was surprising and rather delightful to us was to really see the enduring value of liberal arts education. These were some of our most popular courses: world music, modern and contemporary American poetry, and Greek and Roman mythology were extraordinarily well received. So again, it was very heartening as a liberal arts advocate myself to see that these have a great impact on our society at large. So thinking about this a little more deeply, we want to continue doing this. We want to continue this experiment. So thinking of business models so that we can recover our costs and sustain and do some more investments are clearly important. So some of the things we're thinking about is American Council for Education Credit. Both Duke and Penn have put some courses up to be evaluated to receive credit. So that would mean any institution, and some of you, they may be yours, that accept ACE credit might be interested in using some of our courses. We are in, like it or not, I think we have really moved into the publishing business. We are creating, you know, the online textbook in many ways through some of these courses, thinking about the textbook model, thinking about that, what that means, distribution, and so on and so forth. The interesting thing there, perhaps, is the only business that's even maybe being more disrupted right now is in publications and journalism and so on and so forth. So thinking about textbooks, thinking about text with publishers is extraordinarily interesting. And then thinking about our humanities courses, since they were so well received, you know, is there a subscription model that we can create? Is there a way to create, you know, more content for a smaller audience? So we're thinking about that as well. So numbers, lots of enrollments, lots of courses going on, and I wanted to address, because I think another thing people talk about is issues around registration versus enrollments versus completion, and you know, the debate. There's a lot of debate about that. First of all, I think we are probably over the first land rush of everyone enrolling for, you know, 20, 30, 40 courses. So I think over time enrollments are going to increasingly match registration. I think we'll just see that sort of naturally as a number of courses expand and people are not just gathering, clicking on every single link for no reason particularly. I think the other thing is, even if you are looking at completion numbers of 10%, if you're teaching, you know, a 50,000 or 100,000 student course, professors are still having an opportunity to impact, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 students in a single session in a way that, you know, professors have never really had the, you know, they've been teaching in tens, maybe in hundreds on campus. So for many of our faculty, it's been very rewarding and interesting to have the opportunity to teach so many students and have an impact on life. On their lives. And I have a personal experience there, so I try to sit in on every single Penn course. I sit on every single Penn course we offer, and except the genome science course, I must admit, it was a PhD level genome science course, which almost killed me, and I really didn't get past the polymerase chain reaction. But anyway, I sat in a modern and contemporary American poetry. I've never taken a poetry course, is not in kind of in my knowledge base, and I did not complete the course. I did not complete very many homeworks. But now I look at poetry. I will stop and read a poem or read about poets, or, you know, as these links find me now, I will engage in poetry in a way that I never had before. So a little personal experience. And I think one of the things is we have more data. We can really think about what that casual learner looks like. If we want to engage the casual learner, I think it provides opportunity for faculty members to think about the casual learner. So again, the impact may be beyond just completion rates as well. And that's something we really still need to learn. So a quick look at some of our course listings. Here's what we have at Penn. Clearly, Penn and Duke are large institutions, and this gives us a great opportunity to showcase both our breadth and our depth of scholarship and teaching and learning. So we have a variety of courses up. I don't have the ADHD course. But again, we were going all the way across the schools and campuses. And Duke, again, we have tremendous offerings in terms of what we can provide the public. So I wanted to talk a little bit. I'm going to talk about support models and how we did this, and then Lynn will jump in and tell you a little bit about what Duke is doing now as well. So so the other interesting thing about this is I am now a grizzled, experienced person in this area because I have been doing this job since June. It's like I'm an old-timer, and if you go out to Coursera, the people who were there starting in February, they're like the ancient people in this business. I mean, of course, you have to realize Coursera and companies like Coursera have been in business for a year, maybe. November, I think, is when Sebastian Thrun taught that first class, November 2011. So Daphne and Andrew came to Penn. The provost, Vincent Price, asked some faculty members, a bunch of faculty members who would be interested in talking to them, to join the conversation. After Penn signed the agreement, we went back and talked to some of our faculty to see who would really be interested in teaching a course. And these faculty were truly pioneers. They, you know, in the true sense of the word, you know, slashing down the trees, doing the wagon, you know, the wagon train through the terrain and so on and so forth. I mean, they really jumped off feet first. And I admire them so much for, you know, their interest and bravery and passion about teaching and learning into a space they had really never gone before. We supported it 100% centrally in terms of teacher stipends, TA stipends, a video production support if they needed a copyright, et cetera, et cetera. And we spent a lot of time talking about massively open online courses and open learning on campus. We really used a coalition of the willing, you know, in terms of there was no structure, so we had people across campus who were interested in this and supporting this and doing research and figuring out ways to go forward. So we're still doing a lot of evangelizing and still using a lot of the coalition of the willing. But going forward, we actually have formalized some things. We have a formal proposal process now and a faculty advisory board. Penn is a very, very decentralized institution. We have 12 schools at Penn. Centralized models, top-down models, historically are just not the way. We have responsibility center budget management, so that is not necessarily the way things, centrally managed stuff is not necessarily the way things work. So we've gone to a 50-50% funding model between schools and the center to have schools put some skin in the game and really prioritize what they think is important across campus and where they want to, you know, support teaching and learning on massively open online courses. We have some media campaign. We have out now, increasing articles, writing, and so on and so forth. We have a little more time, catching our breath for a minute, so we're taking a look at thinking really hard about some business models. And then you can collect every click on a user experience in Coursera. And we started to skim the surface of the data. So we're taking a look at data for a dashboard perspective for faculty members to sort of see what's going on in their courses if for any specific time. And also the research component of this data is tremendous. It has tremendous potential. I can't actually think of a discipline there where this might not be of interest, you know, from traditional education practice to consumer behavior to, you know, psychology to just access of big data because the data are bigger and messy and people are interested in problems with big data. So that's another area that we're starting to work on. So I'm going to turn this over back to Lynn.
Thanks. At Penn, all of this happened really quickly at Duke, so our first faculty teaching courses were also, what was it, the Coalition of the Willing, that you said, a mixture of sort of an ad hoc process of reaching out to people and inviting them to participate, combined with responding to people who wanted to jump in and be the first to do this cool new thing. One of the things we did right away, however, that I think was a good idea was we got a faculty governance group to agree to start meeting in July, which is pretty unheard of in terms of getting faculty to start turning out for committee meetings in July. But there was so much interest and debate around this new kind of educational adventure that we did get faculty to do that. And we also have a faculty assessment committee that we put into place fairly early on to start thinking about course-level assessment, program-level assessment, and the possibility of learning research. I'll just mention as a counterpoint, I'm a little bit more skeptical about whether the big data coming out of these courses is going to be quite as definitive in teaching us about how people learn as the excitement around that seems to suggest right now. And one of my reasons for that is that a lot of activity is taking place outside of the courses. We know that students are in Facebook groups. We know they've formed online study groups. They have in-person experiences. And all of that is not captured within the system itself. So unless we really figure out how to reach out and get self-reported data that's accurate, I'm not sure we'll be able to learn everything that we want to learn, although the data sets are big enough that we're bound to learn some things. The second round of proposals is underway right now at Duke. This time we're a little bit more structured. We did send out a formal call for proposals. We do have a faculty group that's reviewing them. We still seem to have people interested from all different schools, so I'm excited about that. And here is some of the feedback from the first couple of courses that have concluded. I have to keep emphasizing that not only has all of this been less than a year in place, but we have only completed two courses so far. Our third one will finish up later this week. But based on the faculty who are either engaged now in teaching courses or were the early completers, all of them found, not surprisingly, took more time than they thought. It was harder than they thought, but it was also much more fun than they thought. One person told me the other day, he said, I get up in the morning and the first thing I look at are the forums in my class, and the last thing I do before I go to bed at night is look in those forums again. They're addictive. I can't pull myself away. Another thing that they have pointed out that they found very interesting, these are all people who have been teaching for years. They're very good teachers. All of them said, I felt certain that I could look out at my classroom when I taught and tell whether students got it or not. I could look at their faces. I could just tell. But I'm finding that the students in my courses are telling me, no, there are things that were not clear. They're pointing out mistakes. They're offering alternative explanations that are better than mine. So many of them are very humbled to realize that there may have been more confusion and lack of understanding going on in their campus courses than they thought, and it seems somewhat ironic that that understanding is coming through their interaction with online students more than their campus-based ones. In terms of what kind of reaction we're getting from students in the courses, Deirdre already mentioned, we all know that the rate of people completing is far lower than the number who sign up. But there's some interesting things that we have to think about here. Across all Coursera courses, and I believe it's pretty much the case across edX courses I've heard, although I don't have the data for those ones, about half of the people that register never log on even once. So those people I would consider not a dropout, 50% not a dropout. They're 50% who expressed some level of interest by registering but never came to the course at all. And then after that, another 50% really don't do much of anything after logging on once or twice. So one of the measures that we are looking at in terms of thinking about what does a completion rate mean is we're using the number of people who completed the assignments in the first week, and then comparing that to completion rates. Even that is not necessarily a good way to measure things, because we know from the pre-course surveys that many people say, I intend to be active in the course, but I don't intend to do the assignments. I want to hear the lectures. I want to engage in discussion. I might look at some of the assignments, but for whatever reason, they feel I don't need to do that. The two biggest things people tell us for why they don't complete the course are they don't have time or they don't have the prerequisite background. So if you think about it, instead of screening people really carefully and ruling lots of people out before they ever are allowed to take a course, we're saying anyone can try, and that screening is a self-imposed screening that happens during the course. Okay, the other thing with student feedback, we've had, two courses that have completed, and we use some of the measures that we use with our campus-based classes, and these courses are about parallel in terms of student satisfaction, students feeling that they learned things, students feeling that the instructor took an interest in them. So we found that to be interesting as well. And I'm going to let Deirdre talk about what kind of feedback they've been getting from the Penn classes.
So we have completed 11 classes, 12 classes running right now. And so, again, I want to really give credit to our wonderful faculty members who have jumped in into this new adventure. So there are a couple of themes here. So I think I mentioned, you know, the ability to reach, if you're a true educator, the ability to have a grander reach is a tremendous motivator to put yourself out there into the world in a brand new format. And so I have Carl Ulrich who taught the fabulous design course. And then I think Peter Strzok's comments here about upsetting more apple carts, you know, This adventure into open learning and working with Coursera is great, but the change in conversation on campus that's going on, the fact that you know, online learning at a place like Penn is no longer a word that people look in, you know, kind of dismay. The fact that you can do quality education in a technology-enhanced format is incredible. You know, people are not saying, you know, it's just incredible, the debate. People want to discuss this. People are interested in this. People are wondering how this is going to impact our teaching and learning on campus, which may be the most important thing we're doing, I think, is taking the methods and, you know, methodologies and our experiences out in massively open online learning, bringing them back to campus, and really transforming a wonderful institution and continuing this institution's ability to transform itself into the 21st century and beyond. You know, and then as Lynn was talking about, you know, student engagement, so I don't know, you may have seen this story in the press and so on. So our modern and contemporary American poetry class, we had Al Filreis had a student who was autistic and could not speak. And he was able to take the class and do well in the class because he was able to do it online. He can type. He taps words in his iPad. But you know, you think about access and teaching and learning and being able to provide a platform for perhaps differently abled people to make that contribution to society, to continue to learn. I think this is just a fantastic story. And I think every institution you talk to who have been providing massively open courses has stories similar to this. This is not a unique story. And we've received a lot of positive response from students as well. One of the things that is a concern when you have faculty time, and our faculty are doing this as an overload. They're not doing it as a teaching, you know, part of their teaching. This is in addition to jobs, their regular day job. The support that goes on in the forums and the responses that go on in the forums, either from TAs who are teaching the course or actual students, is tremendous. And figuring out how we use that engagement back on campus, I think, is interesting. I think the data from Coursera say that it's an average of 7 minutes to get your question answered at any point in time. 24 hours, you know, in a 24-hour time frame, if you ask a question, it takes about 7 minutes to get your question answered. And then I think there are examples. So there's Kevin Werbeck, who teaches a gamification course. He was really quite engaging, and that was an extraordinarily popular course. And people really were saying, I'd really like to see these courses that I'm taking online. But, geez, it would sure be nice to bring some of this information and this style back to in real-life teaching as well. So, okay. And then I think, you know, so I think these are all really, you know, really great kind of ways that this is really informing the discussion on campus, and you know, our feedback has been generally very positive. So then, you know, this has really shaken things up on campus, and I think that is really that's the probably first chapter in this story. So flipping the classroom is very important. You know, students are, you know, increasingly how you can spend valuable student and faculty interaction time really making the best of that experience and not spending time providing information that can be consumed in other ways. You've probably heard of that. I've heard the statement, we're at the end of the era of knowledge scarcity. Have you heard that? You know, so I think this is, you know, and this becomes increasingly important for why a flipped classroom might be useful, because we're not at the end of
discussion and education in an intimate environment. So one of the things we are asking faculty members when they want to reoffer their courses and through our next set of proposals is how you intend to use, a question about how you intend to use your experience offering an open online course back here on Penn campus. Are we in the publishing business? We may very well be in the publishing business, and you, if you want to think about, I'm sure you thought about the implications of universities being in publishing business, right? I mean, you think about disrupting the classroom. Publishing business is far more disruptive. You know, traditionally, well, if you created a drug, a blockbuster drug, or software on campus, that's generally part of a kind of patent, shared IP, shared revenue kind of arrangement in most campuses. If you write a book with your publisher, that has not been part of this arrangement. If all of a sudden university resources are created for publishing, what does that mean? And this is going to, this chapter I don't think has even started, but this is something that's really shaking up, you know, thoughts about campuses. Again, this leads very much into the broader discussion of what 21st century teaching and learning should look like at major universities in the world. And again, as I said, this is for Penn, I think, one of the most important things, and again, my personal experience, trying to shake up perceptions of online learning and teaching and technology-enhanced learning, it's done. It's done in it's this you know, in 6 to 9 months, this conversation has finally moved to, I think, the next appropriate level for where it should be.
So in addition to shaking up teaching and learning, the MOOCs have shaken up the support services and administrative structures at the university as well. Higher education typically moves pretty slowly. And with this whole business, things are moving at breakneck speed. We went from saying, should we try this, to having a course up and running in 16 weeks. That is unheard of in terms of the way curriculum planning and course planning usually happen at the university. The reliability versus innovation, I think, is another one that's been shaken up in the sense that I've worked in academic technology for many years, and we've always assumed, and we've had the feedback from faculty, that things need to be rock solid. It's a disaster if anything goes wrong, ever. Well, this is one where changes are happening on a regular basis. You know, we do this carefully controlled version control process where if we're going to upgrade an existing system, we plan for a year, and then we take a year to test it, and then we take a year to implement it, and we tiptoe in, make sure nothing's working. With this, you know, new versions of the software would be rolling out in the middle of the day, and sometimes things don't work. And given the faculty that we're working with, they would say things like, oh, that's okay. I don't mind if the system goes down when I'm in the middle of my class. It'll come back up. I'm thinking, where were you people the last time I had to make any kind of technology change on campus? I never heard anyone say that. Another consequence of that is I believe that central IT groups and various support services on campus are going to have to consider that trade-off between reliability and innovation. And maybe we really can do things in a more agile way. Maybe we can introduce things a little more quickly, and the world won't come to an end. Our LMS is a good example. We just moved recently from Blackboard to Sakai. It was a very carefully orchestrated process. We already are beginning to hear people saying, well, maybe I'll use Coursera for my campus-based course, or I heard about this other system out there, I might want to use that. So I think we are going to find that we can't control as much from the center as we traditionally have, and that's probably a good thing. So just to wrap up, it's all brand new. We don't know where things are headed completely. The format of these courses is changing rapidly. We've talked about changing conversations on campus. The business models are just beginning to be rolled out. So I don't think we're going to know whether any of those or all of them are going to work for a while. And I think we mostly want to get a chance now to engage with you and hear about your questions and your feedback and reactions. I'm going to do two things before we take questions. One, I'll come back to this in case anybody wants to write it down, but this is how you can get in touch with us. But I was also asked to make sure people know that they would very much like you to fill out the evaluations for these sessions, so please do that. So let me ask you a question, and then I want to hear what kind of questions you have. How many of you have taken whether it's Coursera, Udacity, edX, any of them, have taken one of these MOOC classes. Okay. Some have, some haven't. How many of you have finished one? Okay. Much smaller. All right. I would strongly urge you to get your feet wet by at least enrolling in one and doing some of the activities so that you have an experiential understanding of what they're like. Because I hear a lot of conversations where people will say things like, oh, they're just watching video and that's all they do. And if you've actually been in any of those classes, you know that that's just not the case. And it's important to experience that. So let's see what kind of questions and comments you have. Yes. We're supposed to encourage people to use the microphone, and we will try to remember to repeat the question as well.
Skip Ward, Fort Hays State University in Kansas. I was in a MOOC that, in this regard, gets into the payment feature, sponsored by the University of Calgary. The way they did it is I paid, and I was working on certification in emerging technologies. A group of us paid for the course. There were, 2,000 other people that didn't pay for the course, and we had to do something extra. That's how their model worked. Second point, you had an aha moment. I'm enrolled in a Coursera course, and it started last week, and I kept saying, where's the email that the course is up? Where's the email? And I Googled, I went right into Coursera while you were talking, looking for your courses, and I had my aha moment. I was supposed to go to the website and enter the course. I feel like an idiot. But the old model of getting an email, we're up and running, is gone.
Well, yes and no. All of the courses that we have run have sent out an introductory email saying that the course is starting. But I think you are also correct in that this shifts a lot more of the responsibility to the student and says that, you need to decide how much time you're going to spend on this, how much you're going to do, and you need to participate in things like the forums and the activities to get the full benefit of the class. So students are expected to be a lot more active as opposed to having the professor tell them everything to do. Why don't we swap them? So we have... Yeah, if you could go to the microphones, that'll be great. We'll take people there.
So do students at your universities take these courses for credit and pay for them?
So since the courses are such, as Lynn said, the interesting thing is none of our courses are like the 13, 14, really very few of them are the 13, 14 week courses. So what we've done so far is some of our faculty members have used them as part of the flipped classroom. So they'll point their in real life students to content because it's the same. A lot of times it's the same slides, but they have not taken they haven't taken a full open course on yet. And I actually think that there's some, thinking about, this different standards in terms of, because I think faculty members think, at least have thought about standards for when they're teaching open online versus what they're doing teaching at Penn. I actually think there's some really great applicability. So one of the things that happens with our undergraduates, especially in certain programs such as if they're in a Wharton undergraduate or a nursing undergraduate or if they're doing some joint program, it's very, very difficult for them to go abroad. Right, because they can't fulfill their requirements abroad. So, wouldn't it be nice if we could create an environment where they could go abroad, they could take some classes in the institution they're at, but then continue to fulfill their requirements by taking an online course as well to supplement it? Because I really do believe that part of your education is consuming content, but so much of the rest of your education is beyond that. So,
thank you.
Sure.
My question is probably a broader one about Coursera, etc. So I'm from a university in Australia, and we attempted to be able to offer something on Coursera, and it just seems like they're pretty selective, that they weren't really interested. So I don't know how you actually get your courses online on Coursera. And I know that, you've got different rankings of universities, etc. But there's a number of universities that will probably have unique offerings that are actually not going to be offered on Coursera, so they're actually losing out by not making themselves more open and available to universities that may not be the Ivy League or may not be in Australia, like the Group of Eight. So I just didn't know what your experiences was, or if you've heard whether they're, you know, highly selective, or what's the process?
Sure. This is an example where I think things are so new that it's hard to know what direction Coursera will take. Initially, I think they felt it was important to have a limited number of schools, really get the technology platform developed, test out how well things worked at scale before they just took on a lot more schools. But my understanding is they are still interested in adding additional partners, and what their decision-making process for that will be, I'm not sure. But I completely agree that every school has some excellent courses, and trying to figure out how to broaden the number of institutions that can offer courses this way should be an important goal.
Hi, I'm Melody Buckner from the University of Arizona, and we're actually starting to talk with Coursera. And of course, the first question our provost starts asking us is, how are you going to provide the resources for the faculty? So I'm interested in, how did you support your faculty with resources? I think you said that they do this on their own. So, and then how much time does it take for the designing of the course? And how much time does it take for facilitation? Because it's all about time and money.
So we did, at Penn, we did provide faculty stipends and TA stipends. And we'll be providing stipends for this, a smaller stipend for the second offering. The larger question is how this fits into teaching loads going forward. So, and we really looked at it as an entrepreneurial venture, a startup. So we resourced it that way, knowing that we get some seed funding for this, but we do need to figure out how to make it more sustainable going forward. I'm sorry, what was the second half of your question? So the question about design and facilitation. I think the answer is varies widely from faculty member to faculty member. Some faculty members have taught. We do have a small online program. Some of the faculty members who taught our pioneers did teach online originally. So they used some of that format, but they did redo the work because they realized it was a different audience. Coursera's format with video was a little different than everyone was used to. So I think it really varies. And again, our course lengths really vary. So I think clearly if you're spending more time, a larger course, more extensive, it will take longer, but you know, some of these, like our vaccines course, Dr. Offit had a lot of this information in his head. He could just sort of go. And it also varied in terms of the support model. So some faculty members did everything. They did the on-camera, you know, they bought the camera, they set up their studio, they did the whole thing, they had their TAs, they did Final Cut Pro. We have a faculty member who believes that everyone needs to know how to teach online, so he did most of his course material himself, to very highly produced studio formats that a faculty member would only deliver the content and everything else was done for them. So I think it's good because we're still very much experimenting. So next question.
How about over here? Okay. Yes?
Me?
Yes.
So I'm quite excited about MOOC learning environment because obviously distance is no longer an issue, especially for people who live far away or people who are blind who live remotely and kind of hard to get access to a quality education. My question to you is, have you considered accessibility issues in the MOOC environment, and what do you do about it as far as content is concerned and platform itself?
Do you want to take that?
Sure. So one of the components of working with Coursera is in our contract to provide accessibility. So we actually have some examples. Whether it's perfect or not right now, have you taken a Coursera course?
No, I have not.
Okay. So whether it's perfect right now or not, actually answering your question is, Some of our faculty members had to redo their slides because they had to talk about their content. They couldn't just say it is obvious from the slide, or they really like talking through data and stuff. So there was a fair amount of work, and it is required by Coursera partners to provide accessibility for people with differing abilities. I think given different platforms, speech recognition, a variety of other techniques, I think increasingly will, you know, whether they're open online courses or just education in general, price points have come down for technology as well. I think increasingly it's possible to make sure courses are accessible, whether they're for credit or online courses.
So I just want to have a follow-up comment. I'm very much curious on beyond what Coursera promised you. and I would like to learn more about it if you could introduce me to the right people because accessing content, especially for the deaf-blind, who is probably the most underserved population, they can't rely on video, they can't rely on audio, so those type of content will have to be served to them in Braille. This is something that I would like to perhaps talk to you more about this.
You can follow up offline. It's great.
Hi, I'm Catherine from Brown University. I was wondering if you could talk more about sustainability models that, other than those that reduce access to the open content. You mentioned a couple options that you've considered at Penn, but do you have any other ideas for how you might sustain this beyond the experiments that you're doing?
Are you talking about sustaining production of courses?
I think many institutions are looking at this moment of it being an experiment and recognize that you could put resources into it to learn, but then you mentioned a couple of sustainability options, but it sounds like it would then be closing off access to some of this open content.
Well, who knows what the future will hold, but one of the things that seems highly likely to me in terms of both bringing revenue in to recover costs and then thinking about ways to reduce the cost of production has to do with perhaps having different tiers of things. So there might be a completely open option that you can sign up without anything and you don't get anything at the end of it either. But some of the models provide increasing levels of cost in terms of getting certificates, credit, extra help. That may be part of it. I also think the flip side of that, which is to reduce the cost of doing the production, we're very interested, for example, in finding out how much video production really has to be done at a high level. One of the courses that is almost concluded now, we were very apprehensive because the faculty member did a lot of the production in his basement wearing a hoodie. And we're like, oh my gosh, you know, this is going to be embarrassing. His students adore him. And it's not because the lighting is perfect or he has a really great hoodie. It's because he's very engaged in the discussion. He's a great speaker. For other people, I'm not sure that self-production is going to look as good. So I think we're going to have to figure out what is the most efficient and cost-effective way to do this that still produces a good experience. We just don't know yet. It looks like we're supposed to one more. All right, so we'll take the last question here.
Thank you. My name is Rebecca Griffiths. I work with Ithaca SNR. We're a nonprofit organization. We're conducting a study with the University System of Maryland to see how we can take, how the faculty there can take MOOC materials and use them in their own courses for students enrolled in their campuses. And one of the early observations is that there's a lot of excitement about using these materials, but the faculty want to take, sort of pull the courses apart and take, you know, a module from this course, a module from that course. They don't want to use the technology platform. They kind of want to disaggregate it, which is not at all what the MOOC creators had in mind, I think, when they created these. And I'm very curious how your faculty at your two institutions, how you think they would feel about having their courses disaggregated and repurposed by other faculty for their own teaching.
I don't think we're there yet, but one of the things, one of the reasons why Coursera was so appealing is that the institutions get to retain their own IP and all the content that we create and deliver on Coursera is the universities. So, you know, that right now we're just putting together an archive of all our materials. So whether we totally slice and dice to the extreme of the model you're talking about, the idea of creating learning objects for use in a variety of other ways is something we're just sort of starting on the track. So anyway, I want to thank all of you very, very much for your time, and hopefully we've given you some interesting insights. We'll stick around for a few minutes if you, I guess, outside. Do we have another session here? Okay, we can stick around here if you wanted to come up and talk to us a little bit more. Thanks again so much for your time. Much appreciated.